Welcome to Fire Engineering Podcasts, where each day you'll hear a variety of voices speaking on timely topics facing the American Fire Service. The best way to keep up with fire engineering is via our free daily e-newsletter. Learn more at fireengineering.com/e-newsletter.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Fire Engineering Talk Radio and tonight's installment of the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. Tom Merrill here. It's Tuesday, July 7th, 2020. So glad to have you here this evening or listening in to this show, which is dedicated to our great volunteer fire service and the premise. No, you know what? Let's change it. And to the fact that being considered a professional firefighter has nothing to do with earning a paycheck, but everything to do with delivering competent and compassionate service and taking care of not only our customers, but our own members as well. And this is actually a show for all firefighters, really. It's those who truly believe that developing, maintaining, and upholding a professional reputation is the duty of all of us. It's the duty and responsibility of all firefighters, paid or volunteer. And I'd like to thank Fire Engineering and, again, Chief Bobby Halton for supporting these podcasts, mine as well as all the other great podcasts that are covering so many topics within our great fire service. And I'm honored, so honored, that you choose to listen into my show. And I remain committed to all of you here listening. I remain committed to you to continue to focus on topics of relevance and importance to our wonderful, iconic volunteer fire service. So glad to have you here this evening. Hot here in the Northeast. I spent the day in and out of my pool relaxing. Actually been relaxing a lot the last 2 weeks or so. Been off of work enjoying some family time and some R&R with my family. And five of the six of us anyway, I have four daughters and my wife, and only five of us were able to get away this week. We were all set to go to North Carolina where my one daughter goes to school and remains there all summer. And we were going to go down to a nice Airbnb. But for those who don't know, New York State instituted a mandatory quarantine on travelers coming in from certain states that maybe have high rates of the coronavirus, and North Carolina was on that list as of a couple weeks ago and forced us to call an audible and vacation here in New York State. So we said all week that we made lemonade out of lemons. You know, while I was away, then I found out Louisiana was added to that list. And believe it or not, I was scheduled to fly to Louisiana this coming Friday for a conference down in the St. Martin's Parish, which is a little bit outside of New Orleans. And I felt horrible, but I had to call them and let them know I couldn't make it. And I was slated to present a four-hour program this Saturday, and I had to cancel on them at the last minute, and I just felt terrible about it. And I got to thank Dave Duje and all the other great people associated with that conference for their complete understanding, and I wish them all the best for this weekend's upcoming conferences. I know they had to scramble not only due to me canceling on them, but the venue where they're hosting the event changed at least three times based on how many people were going to be allowed to into the center or the symposium site where they were going to host it, and they had to keep finding new places. And now they got to find new speakers because I had to back out, and I know others had to back out before me. So crazy times for sure, forcing all of us to call audibles, whether it's for a vacation like I had to do with my family or you're trying to plan a nice training event. But I was able to participate in a virtual training symposium recently, just a couple weeks ago, held by the National Volunteer Fire Council, which the symposium was supposed to be down in Orlando. We were slated to go down there, and obviously that got canceled several months ago, but they made it work with a great virtual symposium, and I was invited in to deliver a keynote address on the topic of leadership. So I'd really like to thank the National Volunteer Fire Council for that kind invitation. And you've heard me talk before about the great folks at the National Volunteer Fire Council and all the great programs they have, and I think the symposium and parts of it anyway are going to be available online. So do yourself a favor, check out the National Volunteer Fire Council at nvfc.org. Again, NVFC for NationalVolunteerFireCouncil.org. You'll be amazed. There's some great, great information on that site. Tons of free programs available to the volunteer firefighters and volunteer fire departments out there. So I highly encourage you to go check out all the resources that they have for us volunteer firefighters. And I hope to see you at the United Fire Conference, which will be in Indianapolis in September 21st to the 24th. Probably know by now it's newly created. It's a newly created conference that was put together by Fire Engineering and Clarion, the same folks who run FDIC. It's going to be a little smaller venue, of course, than FDIC. I think there's about 50 instructors or so, but going to be some great content regarding recent topics that we're all dealing with, as well as other important fire service topics. There's going to be some great instructors, as only Fire Engineering and Clarion can bring you. So I hope I can see you there. And rest assured, FDIC will be back in force next April. That's all set and planned for. So let's hope our world is back to some normalcy by then. And if I don't see you in September, I'll see you in April of next year in Indianapolis. And I hope, as July rolls around here, you're doing well. I hope your department's doing well. Things are getting back to a little better than they were here in New York State. We're actually doing better, and you never hear this about New York State with anything, whether it's taxes or cost of living or anything like that, but we're actually doing better than a lot of states. Knock on wood, if you can hear me, I'm knocking on wood. As of right now, that's why they're doing this quarantine thing, because they don't want to bring the virus back from some of the states that are having major spikes. So we're slowly coming back to form here, and we're slowly ramping things back up. As a matter of fact, our firehouse reopened, and what I mean by that is members are now allowed to come in and relax and enjoy the comforts of the house, have a soda, watch some TV, use the exercise room on a limited basis. We have a lot of plans in place and procedures in place to maintain proper social distancing, and we've also gotten back out on the training ground, did a couple of Zoom drills, which worked out great, made some things available online, but we're slowly getting back in to the more personal training out on the training ground. And just last night we held our first monthly business meeting, first one we've had in 3 months. Again, we maintained proper social distancing, but it was so good to get back into the firehouse. It was almost like a reunion, we were saying. Although we couldn't hang out as long as we wanted to, we didn't do the normal social activities. Again, slowly getting back to normal, and I hope you are as well in your hometown fire department. Hey, just a couple of quick things off the fire wire. I always like to keep you apprised of what's going on, and I know most of you listening stay apprised as to what's going on, but just a couple important things that I want to highlight in case you didn't see it, and if you did, just a reminder of some of the information that came out this week. Just yesterday, the NFPA released its annual U.S. Firefighter Fatality Report for 2019, and fewer than 50 U.S. firefighters killed in the line of duty in 2019, which is the lowest number of firefighter deaths reported since the NFPA began conducting this study back in 1977. That's big news, folks. And in addition, there were no multiple fatality incidents, which is also a first. That's huge, huge. Another important note concerning us volunteers, lowest number of deaths of volunteer firefighters, which is another milestone. And also lowest number of deaths involving vehicle accidents and cardiac deaths. So pretty good, pretty good. One death is too many, but we're making strides here. So there were 48 in 2019. 48 firefighters died while on duty. Certainly a large drop. Of that, 25 were volunteer firefighters, but it's still the lowest number of volunteer firefighter deaths recorded. And again, the largest share of the deaths attributed to overexertion, stress, medical issues. 22 of them were sudden cardiac events. Usually those are heart attacks. We've covered all this on previous shows. You've heard me talk about It's important to read these reports and to get an understanding. I recommend reviewing them with your troops at regular training drills, in your department newsletter, at your monthly meeting, however you want to do it. Review it. Let's learn what's contributing to these firefighter fatalities, and maybe next year we'll be down even lower than those 48 deaths. The report is available. Go to the NFPA, nfpa.org. You can get the full report. They're also going to be hosting a free webinar on July 19th to review the reports and talk about this year's findings. And if you want to sign up for that, it's limited, but you can sign up for it. Again, you'll find the link at nfpa.org. Great information and good news to drop below 50 firefighter fatalities. But with the line of duty deaths declining, I got to be that wah-wah, bring you the bad news. This coronavirus is impacting us in more ways than you would think. Obviously, increased demands for service, and, you know, we're not able to be at the firehouse training and things like that. But also, Don Abbott, who is considered the father of May Day studies, if you ever read his reports, he does a lot of in-depth reports regarding May Days and the use of RIT and FAST teams. Well, he just found out that there's been a 35% increase in May Days over the last 13 weeks. And he's conducted 156 May Day victim interviews in the last 3 weeks alone. And he's attributing it to many different things. Some of them pertain to the paid service, but some of them certainly pertain to the volunteer for service. Lack of control over excessive overtime. Okay, we don't get overtime in the volunteer ranks, but relaxing rules because of the current civil, COVID, or related situation and conditions. One May Day, the firefighter was in his 71st straight hour of being on duty. So interesting stats to point out. We've got to be careful that this COVID epidemic is impacting us in more ways than maybe we care to think about, as well as the current civil unrest we're experiencing and some of the other things going on in our country. Folks, let's be careful. Let's watch out for each other. Let's read these reports, and let's pass the information on to our firefighters. And if we're in a leadership role, let's digest this information and see what we can do with it to make everybody's job just a bit safer and bring our firefighters back home to their families. That's what we really, really want to do. So just a couple bits of information that came off the firewire in the last few days that I wanted to share with you. Much more information available to read up on it. Again, nfpa.org. And if you go to the secret list or firefighterclosecalls.com, you'll see the report there from Don Abbott, and there's some links there with lots of other information about the 35% increase in May Days in the last 13 weeks alone. Crazy, crazy. So please be careful and bring the troops home and watch out for each other. So, hey, back in May, we had an interesting and very serious show, but a very interesting discussion about grain bin rescues, and it was well listened to. Actually, it was back in March. I apologize. Back in March show, we had a serious and interesting discussion about grain bin rescues, and it was listened to. I got a lot of feedback on it. And in that show, we touched on the unique challenges that are faced by rural volunteer fire departments. Now, got to remember that many volunteer departments in the United States protect very rural populations. In fact, the majority of communities with a population of less than 10,000 are protected by 100% volunteer fire departments. Now, sometimes I must admit I'm not as familiar with that as I should be, these challenges and unique operations that are in place for the rural communities, because as I said on the show before, my town is roughly 50 square miles, protected by 10 volunteer departments. And aside from one of our departments that is in the north end of our town, we're very, very suburban and bedroom community. And there's a lot of businesses and commercial properties as well. And their town population hovers at 125,000 people. My little 6-square-mile district has about 20,000 residents in it, and we run 12 to 1,500 calls a year. And townwide, everyone runs about that many calls, except our little northern neighbor who run maybe 50 to 100 calls a year. So I'm not as familiar with the challenges faced by the rural firefighters out there, but I know it's an important topic to talk about. I've covered it briefly in some of my shows. I've had some people, when I ask for ideas and suggestions for shows that we should cover, people said, hey, talk about some of the challenges being faced by the brothers and sisters in the rural communities. And that's what we're going to do tonight. I have a very special guest on hand. I have Justin Bailey, who's the chief in the Oliver Springs, Tennessee Fire Department. He's been in the fire service for 20-plus years, and he's also a firefighter in the Knoxville, Tennessee Fire Department. I think it's Knoxville. Now I'm embarrassed. I hope I'm right with that. But either way, he's a two-hatter, and he's certainly well-known. He's a well-known speaker and author. He's written many articles, and I've had the opportunity to take in one of his classes focusing on training and making that a priority in the volunteer fire service. And he's with us tonight to talk about the challenges faced by our more rural volunteer firefighter brother and sister. So I'd like to welcome Chief Bailey on to the show. Are you with me, brother?
Yes, sir, I am.
Well, welcome to the show, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be here, and I like to have all my guests give a little background on themselves, so if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself, maybe start with what brought you into the fire service, and tell us a little bit more about your background, and was I right by saying you're a two-hatter?
I am a two-hatter. I started out in the fire service when I was 16. I had a cousin that started volunteering as a junior firefighter at Oliver Springs Fire Department. Exactly. We have an explorer post there. And when it was between that and another rural department that's our neighbor, this is where a lot of our family was. So when I say I can't say I'm a multi-generational firefighter, but all of our cousins were in the fire service. So it was kind of ingrained in us to serve that way. And he invited me one night. Wasn't looking to really join. Ended up joining the fire department. I joke around with him saying he regrets it ever since. I moved up through the ranks in Oliver Springs before I was ready. And I had a great chief at the time that had a lot of confidence in me, put me in as the training officer. I was 24 years old and had just got my letter saying that I was hired on at my career department. And he had the faith in me to say, hey, catch us up to speed on a lot of things. And from there, I would say the rest is history. But unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. I miss him dearly. And he is the reason that I kept pushing forward, because he never held me back. And that's kind of about me.
Oh, wow. Wow. So, and you probably liked the fire service so much that you decided to become a paid firefighter as well, huh? And that was in Knoxville, is that correct?
That is correct. I've been with Knoxville now for right at 13 and a half years. In that capacity, I'm a master firefighter assigned to the training division. So I assist in running our state program, which is just our in-service, and then our recruit academy. So few hundred firefighters. It's not a large department, it's a medium-sized department, but it's a very urban area. So I respond in the urban area when I'm at my full-time job, and then I go to a small town of 3,200 people and respond in a very rural area after that.
Oh, wow. Hey, I'm gonna switch gears for a minute. I'm gonna throw an audible. We talked about audibles at the beginning, but you mentioned something, and I wrote myself a note because I wanna mention this. So, you mentioned how what got you involved in the volunteer fire service was an invitation. Somebody asked you to come to the firehouse. And this, I just thought of this because last night at our business meeting, I mentioned to the listeners how we actually had our monthly business meeting for the first time in 3 months. We had it at the firehouse again as we slowly ramp up to some sense of normalcy. But anyway, we have a very active committee, one of our assistant chiefs, one of our captains, and a firefighter or two working actively on recruitment. Now, who doesn't need more volunteer firefighters? And we all hear about the recruit challenges that we're having in the volunteer fire service. And my group, very proud of them. They came up with some great ideas. They have signs that are being put on people's lawns saying, hey, we need more members. Please volunteer. Every firefighter is encouraged to take them. And we have cards now that we're handing out anytime somebody expresses interest in joining or asks questions, whether it be at an emergency call. No, not the patient or the poor person who had the fire in their house, but if people are walking around the trucks or whatever asking questions, or at that community event that we all go to, when people are asking questions, we're telling our members to, hey, talk it up. Here's a card you can take with you. All that is great, but you know what the best recruitment tool still is? A personal invitation from somebody in the department to a neighbor, a friend, or someone in the community that they know, a personal invitation to come up to the firehouse and see what it's all about. That has been proven in study after study after study. And it did it for you.
Yes, it did it for me. And I'll look at my small department, and we've got 20 members actively right now. I've got a junior fire department of 5 members, so most of them are about to turn 18. And everyone there right now, everyone there started out with an invitation. And that word of mouth is the best invitation. Actually, I handed out an application tonight. I hope she turns it in and comes back, but her invitation was a personal invitation as well. And that's by far the biggest recruitment tool that you have is your own membership. Yeah. I've tried different methods, but it's still, hey, you have some friends? Yes, I do. Won't you invite them over? See if they're enjoyed it. And I've, like I said, the majority of our department all started out around the same time, all by personal invitation of each other as a friend.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's the cheapest, most inexpensive recruitment campaign you can run. And the other thing, I sat in on your classes, and I know how passionate you are, but sometimes I ask my guests to give their take on this whole premise, or what I said is actually a fact about volunteers being professional and how our residents are owed this professional service, and so many things go into that definition. Now, because you are both a paid firefighter and a volunteer, I'd like your take on that and your buy-in on that. Do you support the premise of my show, or the fact that I'm pretty adamant about it? But you being, you see both sides, and you've been traveling now and doing some talking and meeting firefighters from all over. What's your opinion about that?
So my personal opinion is that a professionalism is not a pay status. It's a mindset. It's action based on the individual. I've been in many volunteer departments that are every definition of professional. They train. They do the things right. They get out. They try to find new membership. Sometimes it is an appearance, and it's a way they walk. Is the way I like to explain it. It's the way they walk. It's the way they carry themselves. Then I've also been in on the pay side that they are very professional, and you've got those firehouses are very professional. But then you still go into some firehouses and paid and or volunteer. You look at the fire trucks. The hose is not put up on the truck correctly. It's just slung together. The truck's not seen a bath in 3-4 months. The tools, you can tell they're dirty, not been taken care of. You can walk into almost any firehouse in America, and within the first, we'll say 5 minutes, you can kind of get that image of, is this a professional apartment, or is this someone that might need a little bit of help or a little bit of work? And I would like to say that you walk in my firehouse and say, yeah, this is a professional fire department. but, you know, I turn the image right on us just as much. We all have a room for improvement, no matter what. You know, I don't like pay status. And when I speak and stuff, we all have room for improvement to be that professional firefighter, because it ain't us. It's really, I mean, it is us that's for, but it's for the citizens that we protect. And ultimately, they're not, you know, number one in my book, because that's, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't exist. We'd be just a social club.
Right. Right. And that's something important to remember. It's more than a social club. And I know sometimes that's a challenge in the volunteer fire service. And I had a member once come up to me at a conference. He was from a very rural department, only ran, I think, 25, 30 runs a year. And he said he had trouble delivering this professional message to his membership because they only ran a few calls. But my message to him was, professional has nothing to do with how many calls you go on. It has nothing to do with what your budget is. It has nothing to do with how many members you have. It's all about being prepared to deliver the best service possible when those tones do drop. And it's all about treating people right and just being a good person. It doesn't matter how big your department is. It doesn't have to be FDNY. It can be ABC Fire Company in Podunk, wherever. And you know what? Be proud and be professional. You can't control your budget in a lot of cases. You can't control the people coming through your door. And, you know, you can't control even what that call's going to be, when that call's coming in. But you can control being professional.
Absolutely correct. And, you know, most people think that it's all based on call volume. And you can have a firefighter run 1,000 calls a month, and it's like they only ran one. But then you can have that another firefighter run 10 calls, and they gain more out of those 10 calls just based on what they pick up from it. That's why I don't like using years of experience, you know, because everybody's experience is different when it comes to that. You know, you can have that 30-year member, but they've not put anything into themselves. They've not put anything into retaining of knowledge that they've gained on those 30 years. So it's like having a brand new guy. But if you've got that 5-year member that soaks up everything that they get, reading books, reading magazines, attending classes, practicing on his own, finding notes that they've found from a call that they may have ran 3 years ago, and relearning what they learned from that incident, in my opinion, they've got more experience, even though they got less time on, just because what they've done with it.
Right, right. Sometimes experience isn't based, or that doesn't matter as much as what you've done with that experience. And I always say time in doesn't, you know, we talk a lot about the senior member, but to me, the professional senior member is the one that, yeah, you've got 20 years in, but you're continuing to still train and pass on your information. Time doesn't always equate into professionalism. It's what you do with that time and continue to do
absolutely
with that time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and you wrote an article. Let's delve into that a little bit. Just in the past month or two, you had an article come out, the bread and butter fire and the importance of the first 10 minutes on the rural volunteer fire grounds. I'd like to delve into that a little bit. And you know, it's a great article. You talk about what we can do to start out on the right path in the rural environment. Maybe you don't get a lot of structure fires, but hey, we still have trucks parked in the firehouse that carry hose and water, right? They're not there for show. So we're expected to, like I said, it doesn't matter how big or small your department is. You know, those rigs exist for a reason. And people are expecting us to be able to respond adequately and safely to the incident and competently handle that incident. Even if we only get a fire every now and then, hey, when it happens, it's go time, and we're firefighters, and that's why we have that hose and why we have those rigs and why we carry water. So let's talk about some things we can do, and we'll follow right through your article, beginning with the response. We're toned out, And right away, we're faced with a challenge. Let's talk a little bit about what we can do maybe to preset or predetermine our response and things we can do to help out that response.
So the premise behind, and I always say this, that I am in one little small community in East Tennessee. So I actually had a great phone conversation with a guy from Utah last week, and he was asking me, and he started diving into like wildland firefighting. I'm like, man, I don't know wildland firefighting, not compared to your wildland firefighting. So I always use this. Every community is going to be different, and I base that article off my community. So right out the gate from the response, in a rural area, you're pretty much behind the eight ball from the get-go. Most people don't recognize that there's a fire quick enough. You've got dispatch call time, and then once dispatch call time, based on how you've got your department set up as far as a response, a lot of times in a lot of rural areas is still responding from home. My area is that one of those areas. So you have time to get, you know, for instance, we had a fire the other night, time for me to get out of bed, time for me to go from my house to the fire hall, from the fire hall then to the outer reaches of our mutual aid agency. All that response time is key. So trying to limit that and also know what resources you need up front. So at Monday through Friday, on a average volunteer fire department, if you go around and poll a room full of fire chiefs there in a rural area, almost every one of them will have the same exact problem. I don't have manpower during the day. Bedroom communities, people commuting to work, working two, three jobs, you know, the manpower ain't there during the daytime like it used to be. So to set you up for success prior to is making sure the resources are on scene as soon as you need them. So I am a big advocate of automatic mutual aid. And for today's rural areas, if you don't have it up front, you're almost behind the eight ball to begin with. And trying to figure out what your average manpower is. I'll use Oliver Springs, for example. During the daytime, it's three people. So we rely on three other agencies to respond with us to meet that manpower for just your average house fire. If it's anything bigger than the average house fire, we're going to have to reach outside of those. Well, each time we reach outside of those, that's an increase of response time for that other agency to get to us.
But you've identified this ahead of time, and you're putting steps in place ahead of time to have the automatic aid ready to go when there's a house fire.
And it's a lot of homework for that agency. So you're doing your homework ahead of time. You're identifying who has the correct resources. Just because your next door neighbor is your automatic aid agency, they might not have the resource you need for that particular kind of fire. For example, being tanker support. Not every agency utilizes tankers, so or tenders, depending on which side of the country you're on. But and if you don't have a tanker, I might have to skip your agency and call for the next one beyond you because I've identified up front you do not meet the credentialing for that incident. One of our biggest areas of need in my immediate area is doing rescue type calls. Well, not every agency does rescue. So we might skip one agency, go to the next one, just to be able to get the resources we need. And it's not us, not to say we don't want to work with the in-between agency. It's just that they don't meet the criteria. So up front, having a good playbook of who has what. And on that, I kind of play into also what I really like harping on is training. But who has the correct training that you need as well. Because just because I get 3 firefighters from XYZ Fire Department, do they meet the need that I have training and experience-wise? Or am I getting 3 brand new guys that may, you know, in my area you can respond with a 16-hour class that not had all the fire training that there is that you need to be considered an interior fireman? Do I need those 3 people? And if they don't meet their credentialing, we've started telling them, sorry, I can't use you, as much as we hate saying that.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it, and it's not just getting on the radio and saying, send me help. It's there needs to be a playbook, as you say. And you know where else that playbook needs to be is at the dispatch center. They should be involved in that too. So maybe you don't have to say, send me the ABC Fire Company. You can say, I need the high angle rescue team, and the dispatch center has the playbook and knows where that team's coming from.
And that plays into, you know, making sure that you've got a relationship with all these different agencies up front. It takes time to get that. To where we're at today took us 15 years of relationship building and training together, and just, you know, meeting each other and saying, hey, what can we do to help you? And what can you do to help us? Mm-hmm. Then changing that over to our dispatch, you know, I know some areas of the United States has more regionalized dispatch. Our area is still very local-based, so there's multiple dispatch centers. So reaching out to each one of those dispatch centers and saying, hey, you know, what's your response protocol if A, B, and C type call comes in? And they'll give you a rundown of what all they're going to automatically send. And then is creating that relationship up front and talking with them, saying, hey, that actually does not meet our needs. We need you to possibly start doing this. And if you go in there demanding things, a lot of people are really taken back by that. So coming up and saying, hey, we would like you to send this to us, it would help us out without us having to start asking for it each time and you're still having to send it. So, you know, having those relationships up front with your dispatch is key.
Right. Well, relationship building is so important, not just with dispatch, but you mentioned about, you know, knowing the training, the capability of the incoming firefighters from other companies. Why not build relationships on the training ground ahead of time? Okay, here's my first 2 mutual aid company, my second 2. Let's schedule some training drills together and get to know each other. And, hey, how about ditching egos? Let's put the ego to the side and focus on what's right for our communities. And, you know, again, I've mentioned numerous times of what do our citizens expect if we need help. They just expect help to be coming from the nearby fire company and expect us all to get along and work together professionally, you know, right? So build the relationship and train with your neighbors and ditch the ego and realize that we can all work together and we all have strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, that's how teams are built. And think of it as a big team.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, getting those trainings together up on the front end, you realize you have more in common with each other than what you mentioned ego. You know, I don't need help because we can handle it ourselves. And that is one of the biggest egos that a lot of departments has had to overcome over the past years, to know that, hey, reaching out a hand is not saying that you can't handle it. It's just saying you need a little extra help, and we're willing to provide it because we're going to need the same help in retrospective.
Right, for sure. So plan ahead, have a playbook that incorporates, you know, who's coming, what resources they're bringing, have an understanding of the people that are coming and their training capabilities. And you even mentioned you might have to think about liability and payment for services if that's required. Have you actually experienced that or heard about some stories with that where there's
So actually I have heard of stories of this. I was in Upper Michigan, up in near Traverse City area, and I was talking with some departments up there, and they charge each other for mutual aid, which was odd to me, being from East Tennessee, and not saying that their system is wrong, because they explained the system to me that they have to charge because of the way that their insurance policies are set up and their they're not really townships up there, but how their individual communities are set up based on laws and mutual aid laws in Michigan, that they have to do that, which to me was just odd because in Tennessee, you don't have to charge your next door neighbor to come, you know, put out their fire. But the way they explained it, they're like, we've been doing this for years. You know, it all pretty much ends up at a what I call a wash. In other words, nobody pays any more for each other because they've all got it budgeted, and they're receiving it back when they provide mutual aid on the other side. But it was odd. I know of some agencies that liability is another issue, is if the next-door neighbor's fire department responds to my call and something, they get injured, whose insurance is going to be caught up in this? Are they covered under their own insurance? Are they covered under your insurance? And that's usually a lot of when you set up your mutual aid policies and you set up your agreements, that is already predetermined prior to you calling for that first initial help. I know of some departments that share apparatus, which is, you know, to me it's kind of odd because of just the idea of, all right, who is responsible for this apparatus? But there are some agencies that do that. And everybody is a little different. And that's why I always say, hey, I'm in East Tennessee. You know, East Tennessee is different than, you know, Kentucky, or different than, you know, North Carolina, or even New York at that sense. Because all of our laws that are at a local and a state level are just, you know, it's, on the surface they look the same, but there is always something that's just a little bit different that makes our situation different.
Yeah, you know, it boils down to good communication with your neighbors and other jurisdictions, and planning things out ahead of time, and having, you know, if that's something that's got to be discussed about the payment for services, then so be it. But you figure that out ahead of time. And how about just putting together a good chiefs association or some kind of town or county organization where the leaders from the various departments get together on a regular basis, be it most likely monthly, and with today's technology and obviously with email capability and things, there's so much you can cover as a group and get a lot of these hurdles worked out ahead of time through good communication, and so you're all on the same page. And I know one of the hiccups that you talk about too, and it makes total sense, and I can use our area as a great example, and that's having some sort of standardized SOPs so you're all on the same page of the playbook depending on what incident you're going to. For example, we now have automatic mutual aid coming in for our structure fires, and we're working it out where, okay, if we arrive first, we know if our second due engine gets there what it's going to do. But now if the automatic aid second due engine gets there, do they know what we're expecting them to do? It sounds silly, but these are the things that can lead to a dysfunctional fire ground when people aren't thinking the same way or don't have a playbook where they know what to do. So I can see your point that this takes time to do.
It does, and a lot of that, like with your SOPs, a lot of that's worked out with just good old-fashioned training.
Right.
Being together, working out, drawing it on a whiteboard of what each other is supposed to do. The three departments that, and I'm included in this, the three departments that respond primarily together right here in the Tri-County area, our SOPs are a little different, but they are almost identical at the same time, because we've worked that out over the last 15 years to be able to know that, hey, even if my engine arrives on scene first into the neighboring jurisdiction's territory, the neighboring jurisdiction, do we have hiccups? Yes. But it goes smooth because now that jurisdiction knows, oh, okay, now I'm just water supply instead of, I'm coming in to be the primary engine. I'm going, I expect something completely different. And, our command structures have changed in that as well. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because now it's not dependent upon, this jurisdiction's chief has to be in charge, or this jurisdiction's firefighter has to be in charge. It can be, Oliver Springs' fire chief or even member can be in charge, just because, we've worked that out ahead of time. And that just boils all down to something that you have to sit down and actually do. You can't just mm-hmm. assume it's going to happen.
Right, you put the time in. So you mentioned incident command, and in you talk about the differences between an herbal incident commander and a more rural incident commander, and how that can be very, very different and present some unique challenges for the for the rural department. Could you expand a little bit on that and what your take is on that?
I can't expand into that. An incident commander in the rural area has to be able to be multifunctional. And the reason I say that is because limited manpower. Whereas in a rural or more urban setting, you're going to have, 13, 14, 15 guys get there within 3 to 5 minutes of each other. Whereas in your rural area, you show up, there's two members to three members on scene within the first few minutes of each other, but you're required to wait on your mutual aid agency for your additional three members. Then you're required to wait on another additional 10, 15 minutes for another mutual aid agency that might bring 4 or 5 members with them. So it's spaced out. So that first initial instant commander, not only does he have to focus on the instant, making sure the resources are there, doing a 360, what kind of tactics you're going to utilize on that fire, he also might be, and I use he very loosely, he or she might also be, he or she might also be focusing on making sure that the pump is in gear, making sure that the water supply is established, making sure that everything is put in place that you need in place from the get-go.
Yeah, because that rural incident commander may be wearing many different hats on the fire ground, especially if he's there with just one or two other people for a short time or a long time, whatever the case may be, right? They could be pulling hose line or maybe even fighting the fire for a bit until help gets there. So I guess that makes it a little harder to focus on running the show.
I jokingly always say it's called John Wayne firefighting. I have been that initial responder on scene by myself with a apparatus. So I was also the instant commander. I was the pump operator. I was also pulling hand lines and starting the fire attack. And by the time I was starting the fire attack, my additional responding help was starting to trickle in and arrive on the scene. Is it ideal situation? Absolutely not, but unfortunately it is played out every day across rural America because you might only have that initial responder that's very close by that can pick up the engine. So you have to make a decision. Do I sit there and wait for 4 members to get there at the fire hall respond as a complete unit, but now my response time is being increased by 10 minutes? Or do them responders go ahead and have turnout gear with them and respond directly to the scene, and I bring the truck with me? So we reduce that response time down to 5 minutes. The key for anybody that is in a rural area really is that be able to be multifunctional if you need to be, because it does make you a little bit more well-rounded, but at the same time, it's also very challenging. And, you know, also on the danger level, it's dangerous, unfortunately. Just because, you know, we try to automate as much stuff as we can. Just because if I don't, because I'm having to do those multi-roles, I might miss something. You know, that's something that I don't need to do.
You talk about the utilization of a checklist for or a command type board to assist any young incident commander, right? So is that something that can try and think of what can we do in the rural setting to help these young incident commanders out, or any incident commander, to run the show maybe a little more efficiently?
I like checklists. I like checklists for incidents that are not your everyday incident. So, for instance, if I'm responding to a commercial fire, it happens, but it's not very often in my area. So I have a checklist of, hey, do I have all my resources on scene? Is certain resources on scene that I need? Have I secured the utilities? Just a little mental checklist of, hey, what do we need on scene? And what that plays out for is, what happens if your newest member that just completed Firefighter 1 rookie school is now the instant commander, and they're faced with just an everyday house fire? Well, either one, they may freeze up, or they may start shortcutting things. So having a checklist might help them just, you know, be able to hit benchmarks that they need to look for. And I'm not looking for, you know, you see some command boards, they're big, they're elaborate. A simple just, you know, arrived on scene, is utility companies coming, mutual aid, is all victims accounted for, just simple stuff, just to kind of jog the memory of what the agency manager needs to be asking for up front.
Yeah. And you talked, you know, I know some listeners out there might have a hard time believing that, you know, someone that young or with just a year or two on could end up as an incident commander, but that's very real in many volunteer fire companies. Doesn't even have to be a more rural volunteer fire company, but I guess that's something that they need to be made aware of as they're going through their training. And also maybe we need to get them incident command training sooner than later as well.
Yes. And like, I'll use our department as an example. We have had that scenario played out a few times. That has been one of our newer members that has arrived on scene and been the initial incident commander until somebody of rank and or more experience shows up a little later on and is like, hey, I got it. And what we've done is we started implementing, a lot of it's on training nights, but we started implementing more scenario-based training. Just, hey, you know, here's your fire, what would you do? And just using simple, you know, I don't like saying that we use YouTube training. We don't. But using a simple video of a house fire and then pausing it and saying, all right, you've seen the house fire, what's your next actions that you need to do? And it has helped our younger members be able to step up into that role and be able to make those critical decisions early and with a little bit more confidence. So we like simulation-based training because we can't go out and, you know, have live fire training every other day. So that helps build that muscle memory for that member. That way at 3 o'clock in the morning, they've already kind of got trigger points in their mind of, hey, have I made sure that my water supply is established?
Yeah.
Have I, you know, thought about what tactic I'm going to utilize instead of, you know, offensive, that, hey, maybe we step back, we do a transitional attack, and then we go interior. You know, just mental checklist. That way they've got the tools in their toolbox very early on.
And if you have some subtle reminders in that checklist or at the command board, just some little simple things that can help anybody steer them in the right direction or provide that needed reminder about whether it's utilities or just whatever's on that command board. Just that's a great idea that can help not just the young firefighter, but even an experienced leader. You know, sometimes you forget things and you know, it's like a trusted aide. You know, the big cities have the trusted chief's aide, right? Well, that could be such an important aid to the incident commander. And again, you're doing this ahead of time to make yourself better prepared for that incident when it happens. And I got to give you a big kudos, too, when you talk about watching YouTube. Because you know what? YouTube can be a great training tool if you do it professionally. You're doing it to learn from and not criticize and blast other departments. The professional thing to do is watch these videos, apply those scenarios to your department, talk with your members, what would we do, what would you do, what would our SOP, SOG be here, and not to get on the frickin' keyboard and start annihilating these poor departments, if it's in fact a bad video. I'm not saying the videos are all bad, but if it's something that you want to do in your department, great, okay, talk about it in your department, and then shut up. Stop getting on the keyboard. Sorry, I get fired up about these keyboard people out there. But kudos to you because you can use YouTube. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Use it the right way, the professional way, and don't tear the brothers and sisters apart because that's not brother and sisterhood. That's not professional at all.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
Yeah. You also talk about the challenges of the size up in the rural environment. I guess I never really thought about that much. You know, I thought size up is size up, but you have some great points about the challenges there for the rural department. What are some of those?
So, if you're in more of a suburban, urban environment, you can typically pull down the street. You're 50 to 100 foot away from the front door, and you can see three sides just pulling up on the house or on any kind of structure. Whereas in your more rural environment, you're 500 to 1,000 feet off the road down their gravel driveway, and when you pull up, you can only nose into the structure, so you're only seeing one side. That's the first challenge. It's just access. Another issue is if you're doing a 360, in my area, it's a lot of ridges and a little bit of mountains, and they'll build houses on the side of the mountain. So you'll start around to do your 360, and next thing you know, you're on a bluff. And you have a challenge of trying to get around and doing your entire 360. So a 360 becomes more of a 180, and hopefully you can find a place to find the backside of the house. I've got some friends that are in a more western side of the state of Tennessee, and I've spoke with them and stuff like that. And even some of the suburban departments are running into this because as cities annex, they're running into that same scenario because what used to be the countryside is now – annexed into their city. So there is a couple departments that has a lot of McMansion type houses in their jurisdiction. So they've started utilizing technology, drone footage. You know, if you have a drone program, it's great. You know, pretty much any department can get one of those now, you know, for fairly cheap. I would love to say that I have one. I don't. One of my mutual aid partners does. But, you know, we've not utilized that yet. But, like, again, I know of departments that have. And they've, you know, wildland fires is one of the more better scenarios to using drones because you don't always have that visualization right up front in front of you. You might have to rely on, you know, computer feedback of what you're actually seeing. So,
you know,
just
it's funny.
You
mentioned Wildland, and I got to say, you know, again, I ask for ideas and suggestions from the listeners out there, and I get a lot of emails, and somebody did suggest I will do it, I need to do a show on wildland firefighting and for the volunteer fire. If anybody out there has a guest someone that they could recommend who would be a great resource to talk to about that, I'd be more than happy to do a show on that. Shoot me a line. I'll have my contact information at the end of the show here, and shoot me a line if you got someone that you can recommend, and I'll be happy to schedule a show on wildland firefighting. So, but with size up, yeah, I never thought about those challenges, and you know, in the rural environment, drone is a great idea. We're seeing more and more of the usage there, and I could see how that definitely could help out in the rural environment. And what a challenge being 1,000 feet off the road. And, you know, I'm in my house here that's just 25 feet, if that, off the road, and walk around my house in about 30 seconds. So a little different in the more suburban bedroom-type community or urban type community than what's out in that rural area. So, I also like to remind folks, hey, take a quick break here. You're listening to Fire Engineering Talk Radio and the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. Tom Merrill here, so glad to have you listening in, and so glad to our guest, Justin Bailey, who is the fire chief in Oliver Springs, Tennessee, and he's also a firefighter in the Knoxville Fire Department. And tonight we're talking about the challenges faced by the more rural fire departments. Again, many volunteer departments are protecting rural areas in many communities with a population of less than 10,000 are protected by 100% volunteer departments. If anyone does happen to have a question for me or Chief Bailey, I neglected to give the number. You're more than welcome to call. Any questions you have, you can call us at 760-454-8852, and we'd be happy to talk with you. And, Chief, thanks for being on here with me. And so let's talk about, okay, we've got these rural challenges, lengthy response times, long distances, reduced manpower, maybe inadequate water supply right off the bat. We're set way back in off the road. Incident commander might have to take an attack line, blah, 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 all these challenges. What can we do ahead of time to make for a more successful fire attack? Let's talk just our bread and butter fire. What are some of the initial fire ground tactics that we can get done ahead of time to make us better prepared for that bread and butter fire?
So this is where setting up your engine apparatus is going to come into play. Making sure that I envision it this way. If I figure up what 95% of my call base is going to be and I can meet that challenge, that's what my engine needs to be set up for. And I use the engine because that's the most basic fire apparatus that everyone has. And setting it up. And what I mean by setting it up is setting it up for fire attack. So making sure that you have options. And I like the word options because I'm going to pull up to a bread and butter house fire, and I need to have the options on, you know, based on this fire size, is it small, medium, or large? So when I say small, medium, or large, I set up my attack lines based on small, medium, and large. Small is 1 3/4 inch. We run a 7/8 inch tip on one crossway, and we run a constant gallonage on the other one. And we use that setup because both of them pump at the same discharge pressure. So simplicity is key. All of your attack lines need to be set up so that one person is able to pull that attack line by themselves without anybody aiding them. And so we utilize kind of a modified Minuteman load for us. It works for us. We use kind of a Cleveland load attached to a flat stack. So it works for us. We adopted it from a neighboring department because a lot of my members are also members there as well. Then having that medium line tech set up, 2.5-inch hand lines. And 2.5-inch hand lines, if you go and start talking rural firefighting tactics, for a long time they were scared of pulling 2.5-inch tack lines on house fires that's got three or more bedrooms on fire, or rooms on fire, excuse me. And I love the 2.5-inch tack line because I can flow a large amount of water and still be mobile enough to move it to a what was a basement or what was the garage or a garage that's on fire. I can hit it with that 2.5-inch tack line and knock it down. Then large hand or large, if I'm dealing with large water, I'm dealing with deck guns or pre-connected blitz fires or mercury nozzles, using them as an example. Having some kind of pre-connected line that can flow 500 gallons plus per minute. And a lot of times in the rural area, water supply is the biggest issue. And they think, well, if I'm going to attack that fire and I use this large attack line, that I'm going to waste all my water. Well, when I'm talking to people a lot of times, I say, well, you know, I'm 6'4 and 230 pounds, you know, and you're 6'4 and 295 pounds. And I come up to you and I use the small attack line and I come up and I smack you. What's going to happen to me? And a lot of people are like, well, I'm going to punch you. And I say, yes, you are. That's the same thing as coming up and, you know, attacking a very large fire with 1.75 inches because you're afraid to waste water or afraid that you're going to run out of water. I said, but if I come up with a 2.5-inch or if I come up with a deck gun and I use it on this fire, it's like me coming up and punching you square in the nose. You might come back at me, but I have a better chance than you would if I had just come up and smacked you. So that large deck gun is that deck gun and 2.5-inch hand lines, that large punch to that fire. And that large punch, get the fire knocked down. I'm not saying, you know, sit there and spray a 500-gallon deck gun for, you know, 3-4 minutes. I'm saying hit it, get it darkened down, then switch over to your smaller hand lines that are a little bit more mobile so that you can get in there and attack the fire and use minimum water. That is the biggest key, is this initial setup of your truck prior to even getting there, and have it set up to fight fire.
Small, medium, and large. What a great way to think about it. And, yeah, the water, I've heard the expression before, the water's not there for ballast. Use the water you have. Give it a good punch. And you know what? I've heard the argument before from a company that they didn't like using smoothbore tips because, yeah, it went through water faster than their combination nozzle. And it just was like it didn't make sense to me. But, yeah, I like put the water on the fire. Water makes everything better. So, but water supply is a challenge for our more rural counterparts. I'm fortunate, again, in my area, we have a hydrant every 500 feet. And we don't do tanker shuttles or anything where I'm from. And I'm spoiled. And that's what I was born and raised with. Every 500 feet is a fire hydrant. So what recommendations do you have to the brothers and sisters in our rural communities to maybe make their water supply challenges a little better off? Or a little better.
So, water supply is probably one of the bigger challenges we face. I'll use my small community. I go from a good hydrant system to no hydrant system within about 3 miles of each other. So, I've got a very diverse area. So, we run pumper tankers. I run 1,250 gallons on board on both my trucks. Then my mutual aid agencies run a minimum of 1,000 gallons on their frontline engines. So getting that initial water up front, well, then we start talking tanker shuttles and doing different kind of, you know, nurse tanking or tanker shuttle. But a lot of those agencies have it to where they're running an engine and a tanker, and within the first 5 minutes they're showing up with 2,800 gallons of water. Plus their mutual aid agency, so they're coming with water on wheels, is what they're coming with. And pre-planning goes into play when it comes to tanker shuttles and water supply in the rural area. I've had chiefs say, well, I don't have water in my area. And I'd pull up a Google map of their area. And I start pinpointing ponds in their area or pinpointing a water stream in their area. I'm like, you have water. You've just got to map it out and know where your water is. I'm a big advocate of using technology for this because a lot of it's SOP driven, making sure you have enough water on scene from the start. But just as important is knowing where you're going to get your water from once you use that water. So I utilize technology, an app on a phone. If you don't have the technology, use a map books and go ahead and marking where your water sources are. Again, 20 members, all 20 of my members have access to where our water supplies are just by one click of an app on the phone, and they're able to pull it up. So what that benefits, we share that information with our mutual aid partners as well. So if we are doing a tanker shuttle inside of Oliver Springs, I can say, all right, pull up the map. There's where your fill site's going to be at, or here's where the best site's going to be to get your water. And that plays so important to rural water supply. I was on a fire just this past weekend, and the same discussion come up, hey, where is the nearest fill site? And we were dealing with five different mutual aid fire departments all on this one fire, and very rural area, and they were able to pull it up on an app and say, it's right here. Here's where it's at. That's where you need to go. And we never, once that initial happened, we never lost water after that. So that's very important, is pre-planning your water supply.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, like, divide it into zones to help predetermine the fill sites too. And again, a little bit of work ahead of time. Communicate it with your mutual aid partners. Train with your mutual aid partners. Have a county or town association where you're sitting down and talking ahead of time and getting things worked out. A lot of good ideas there. And what can we do to get that water even a little faster? I think you had some recommendations about quick couplings and
Yes, and things change depending on, you know, technology and also based on area. A lot of departments use normal standard thread or NST, but a lot of your agencies that haul water, and that's what they're really good at, they start using petroleum couplings or even Storch couplings. You know, something that's just a quarter turn or two pins that are going to hold your couplings together. And that way, it's a quick fill site, quick dump site. So when I say quick dump site, go ahead and have in your I don't like nurse tanking. I'm a big proponent of dropping tanks on the ground and dumping the water. That way, that tanker, once he drops his 2,000 gallons, he can be on the way to the fill site while the fire truck on scene is utilizing that water. Then when he gets to the fill spot, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I got to stop you because you got a naive, more urban, suburban firefighter here, former fire chief. Nurse tanking, did you call it? I've never heard. I'm sorry. I'm completely lost on that.
I apologize. So nurse tanking is where if you're operating the engine that's primarily on scene, you're the fire attack engine. I'm coming up with a tanker, and all I'm doing is pumping you my water. I'm not dropping my water off. I'm just pumping you my water. And when you're doing that, I'm tying up that tanker until all 2,000 of my gallons are offloaded onto you, and then I can drop and then go to fill up. It slows down the operation when you start doing that. So instead, you'd want to get that tanker to where they drop their dump tank off and they dump their water. That way they can go ahead and start heading to fill up prior to the on-scene firefighters running out of water.
So it makes total sense to me now. I can see the image,
okay,
and now I know why they call it nurse tanking. No, no, no. That's all right. Hey, that's got, you know, I learned something new, which is that's a new one in my book, and I wrote it down here, nurse tanking. But I can totally picture the image there. I can totally understand why it's called nurse tanking. So, but
and,
not a fan of that.
And it's dependent upon, really, also, I mean, are there scenarios we have to do that? Absolutely. The other night was one of them scenarios. We didn't have an area that we could drop a tank just because the way that the roads were. So it's kind of like everything, even in the more suburban, urban area, everything's situational. There's 50 ways to do the same job, but, you know, picking which one of those 50 ways for that fire is key,
yeah.
for that. So,
right. Sometimes you got to call an audible. You have your playbook, and everyone plays to the playbook, but hey, every now and then you got to call an audible. You know, another thing I wanted to ask about with the rural environment is it's always intrigued me, and you put it in your article about using experienced drivers because you do have size and weight considerations with the tanker apparatus. And one thing I remember, and I is this still common where government agencies or the government sold rural departments used government apparatus that were just converted to tanker trucks? Or is that still going on? Because wasn't that a problem with driving? And sometimes we had very inexperienced drivers rolling these rigs over. They weren't even built as a fire truck, but they were converted and then sold cheaply to more rural departments because, you know, for budget considerations. Is that still a thing in the rural areas?
I would love to say no. It is still a thing. There are some departments that are still converting trucks to be tankers, or tenders, depending again where you're at. I want to say it was the United States Fire Administration put out a report a few years ago on tankers and the dangers of tanker usage in the fire service. And in that report, goes over several of the dangers of doing the conversions and why we shouldn't be doing the conversion. So a lot of times they'll take a old military truck, take the military markings off of them, and they would go ahead and put a tank on it. That still happens today. So a department might have an old tank sitting out beside their station, so they'll buy a flatbed truck and they'll mount it onto the flatbed truck. You know, it's kind of a catch for them because they're running into funding issues. They don't have the money to buy even a used apparatus, depending on the area that you live in. Some departments are very good. They get tax-based. Some departments is all donation-based. And if it costs, you know, $100,000 to buy a used tanker and the department's operating on $25,000 a year, they're going to find a way to get the water that they need. If it's converting an old gasoline tanker into hauling water, which has its own set of challenges because the baffling is different and, you know, the weight capacity is different. You know, all that plays into that. And, you know, the biggest thing is that I would highly recommend any department that runs tankers read that report.
Yeah, yeah. And where was that available? Who was it? Was it the fire administration, did you say?
I want to say it was the United States Fire Administration, and I could be completely wrong on that. I'm trying to serve that back from memory.
Okay, but either way,
but
you still better.
Years.
It's something to be aware of.
Yes, sir, it is.
Yeah, and you want experienced drivers, and I know, you know, it's another thing I talk about sometimes is in the volunteer fire service, we're desperate for members.
Well, in a lot of cases, we're also desperate for drivers, so some departments, it's not uncommon. Congratulations, you're a brand new member, and a week later, you're driving apparatus because we need drivers near around during the day, and holy cow, maybe we're not giving them the training they need. Or we know in a lot of cases we're not giving them the training that they need, but especially in these tanker shuttle operations, it's good to have some experience there, isn't it, Chief?
It is. It is. So one of the things that I always recommend in some places, and every community is a little different, if you've got an old, I say old, that's a bad way of putting it, a seasoned retiree that drove 18-wheelers. He doesn't want to fight fire, but he wants to help out. Well, who more do you want to drive a apparatus that's hauling 2,000 gallons of water than somebody that used to do long haul trucking all the time? You know, it's one of them things that you got to play to the hand that you're dealt. So if you've got a gentleman that wants to join the fire department, he's not capable of you know, going interior and doing firefighting duties, but he's like, hey, I drove, you know, my entire life. You want that individual because, you know, they're, you know, time behind the wheel over years equals experience. So I don't want to put a 18-year-old to 21-year-old behind the wheel of a fire apparatus. I need them to be fighting fire. I don't need, you know, I need somebody a little bit more experience behind the wheel to be wheeling that fire apparatus for them.
Yeah, yeah. Very important, too. That's a whole other, you know, we talked about that a few times on this show, just about opening up our minds to other ideas for membership. And you know, not everyone's going to be a frontline interior firefighter. And there's a great example of another job for someone in your community that maybe they would step forward and volunteer to do something like that. All just very, very good points. And we're getting close to an hour and a half, so I'm going to wrap it up here in a minute, Chief. But I just want, for our listeners, I want them to know that I did have an opportunity to sit in on your class a year or so ago. Very good class. Training is a priority in the volunteer fire service, and training is something I talk quite a bit about. And I believe firmly that as long as you choose to wear the volunteer fire service badge and put the sticker on the car and wear the t-shirt and hat and everything, no matter what role you play in your volunteer fire department, it's important to be on the training ground. Even if you're an exterior scene support member, even if you are the driver of that tanker truck and that's all you do, you need to be on the training ground making yourself the best you possibly can be and being prepared. And Chief, you do a phenomenal job in your class talking about the need to focus on training in our volunteer firehouses. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just taking a minute or so about telling the audience some of your thoughts about training and what we can do to make it a priority and set the tone in our firehouse that, you know, everything begins and ends with training. And I know you do a great job, and I share your beliefs about making training a priority.
Thank you very much. Everything that we do boils down to being prepared and being trained. If you have any issue in the fire service, almost all of it can be boiled down to it might be a training issue. So a lot of times I'll tell people, if you join, for instance, you join the Auburn Springs Fire Department, hey, welcome to the fire department, guess what? These are our training nights. This is the training you're going to go to up front. So by doing that, you set the tone right up front with that new member saying, hey, by the way, yes, we do train. You're expected to train. And you have to, you know, we were dealing with adults. You have to make them realize why they need that training. If you don't do that, and you're just, for instance, if I was in Oliver Springs and I said, all right, we're going to do high-rise class tonight, I would lose every single one of my members within 5 seconds because I have zero need to know about high-rise firefighting in Oliver Springs. The biggest building I have is three stories. I'm not dealing with an urban setting. So you have to make that training, you know, for adult learners, you have to make it relative to what they're doing. So setting the tone up front, making sure you don't waste their time. Make sure it's job applicable. So if we're dealing with a lot of tanker shuttles, hey, we're going to do tanker shuttle training tonight. This is why. Always explain the why behind the training that you're doing. Even if it's a regulatory training, you know, you got your NAMS, ICS, they absolutely have their purpose and why we do those, but they're regulatory based, so you have to do those. Bloodborne pathogen, they have a purpose, but they are regulatory based, so you're like, you have to explain up front, this is why, this is how it's applicable to your job, but it's also, this is the reason we have to do it. So doing that, you're not wasting the firefighter's time. So they're more applicable to come back the next day or the next time you're having training. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with making it fun. Because even if we're having a quote-unquote water war, you know, just using that as an example, you're doing hose handling skills, you're doing water supply skills, you're doing so much of these other skills, but you're also having a fun day with the guys. Doing, you know, just basic training. You see departments on the air now all the time doing drills that are fun, but they have a purpose. The key is don't lose focus of that purpose and don't waste those members' time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't say enough about setting the priority up front, saying, hey, we're going to do this. And after you preach that enough and you stick behind that, it won't be the fire chief doing that anymore. I hardly ever give that speech anymore. I still do by the time I bring them on, by the time I get to them, but by the time they get to me, usually they've already heard that about four times. And it becomes almost just a message that your membership starts telling them up front, hey, welcome to our department. We train. This is why we train, and we expect you to do the same thing. If not, we're sorry. This is not for you. And sometimes you have to make that hard choice of saying, I'm sorry, this is not for you, because you won't do X, Y, and Z. And in that X, Y, and Z is training.
Yep. And everybody does it, right? 20-year member, 30-year member, you want everybody there working together because you are a team.
Absolutely. And the newest member can teach the oldest member something.
Yeah.
And the oldest member will teach the newest member.
But that would require ditching our ego, wouldn't it? And the ego gets in the way so often.
But it's also funny sometimes, because the newer member will show an older member that's been on the department quite a while how to do something, and the older member's like, huh, I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
And it's just one of them. It's a round robin. It's fun. It makes things fun. It makes things just showing up fun.
Chief, I had a note here from your class. Do you still do levels of training on the helmets? Wasn't that something you mentioned that was done in your department?
Yes.
Could you explain that?
I can explain that. So the levels of training on our helmets is based, you know, it goes back to that mutual aid and the rural firefighting thing. It was implemented by our Fire Chiefs Association for one of the counties I respond in, and it got adopted across our department. It wasn't mandatory for us, but what it does, it allows me as an instant commander to see the level of training on any member's helmet on scene and know within 2 seconds whether that member can do a job I'm about to assign them to do. And that's based on a countywide mutual aid policy that we implemented. So a level one firefighter for us is a 1-2-3 system. A level one firefighter for us is a new firefighter. They're not cleared to do interior firefighting. They can do other fire ground related tasks that does not put them in the IDLH atmosphere. A level two firefighter is cleared to do interior tasks, they're cleared to be in the ideal H atmosphere, but they need to be with a level 3 firefighter, which is a senior firefighter. And when I say a senior firefighter, that's somebody that's either been on, that's achieved, State Tennessee has a minimum training standard that's not based on, it's kind of based on Fire 1 and 2, but it's still not. They've either achieved that plus some years of training and some additional classes, or that level 3 firefighter has achieved firefighter level 1 and firefighter level 2. So they have that base thing that I can put them as a group leader. So they can do other tasks and be, in essence, responsible for that level 2 firefighter. That way, that level 2 firefighter, I'm not sending two brand-new interior qualified firefighters in by themselves. I've always got them with a team leader. And that's multiple departments that participate in that. And it helps out. Knowing up front, hey, this firefighter can do this. And I've been put in those situations as we first started implementing it, that we've had that brand new firefighter that wasn't interior qualified end up going interior because somebody didn't know that they wasn't and assigned them the task. So it was a safety mechanism.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really neat idea. That's unique, and that I, like I said, I wrote that down in your class, and I was interested to see if you were still using that. And the last note I had from your class, which I'd like to share, and I use this, I paraphrase it all the time because I believe in it so much. You know what, folks? You're a firefighter. Be a professional firefighter. And as Chief Bailey says in his class, you have a personal responsibility to your family, your fellow members, and their families as well to go home safely, for all of you to go home safely. And you do that through training, and training hard and regular, and you're part of the team, whether you've been in a month, 5 years, 10 years, or 30 years. It doesn't stop ever. And that's the message that I got out of your class, Chief. And then you went into a lot of great ways how to focus and make training a priority. Great class.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So we're approaching an hour and a half. I think it's probably, you know, time to wrap it up here. And I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about, I think we just touched the surface of the challenges faced by the more rural departments, and you know, some of the solutions, obviously, planning ahead, have a playbook so you know who's coming and what they're bringing and some idea of the training level and who the people are in these departments. And by meeting ahead of time and talking ahead of time at regular, whether it's a chief's association or some type of county association, where you can lay out this playbook and even establish some basic SOP, SOGs that are going to be followed to get everyone on the same page. And you do that ahead of time, understanding the challenges of rural incident command and how you need to be multifunctional. I love the line, you might be a John Wayne firefighter where you drive the rig, you're the incident commander, you're pulling the hand line and maybe even starting the fire tack while commanding. And you might be a new, relatively new firefighter, and you turn around and you're running the show. So it's important to get some incident command training early on in their career, and also maybe put together a checklist that they can have with them, or a command type board, which an incident commander can use to give them some guidelines and ideas and reminders of how to make the operation go a little bit smoother. The size up challenges, you know, the rural setting of the house is 1,000 feet off the road. A 360 may take you an hour and a half to complete, or you might end up falling off of a cliff or finding yourself on a bluff. So consider things you can do ahead of time, maybe drone technology, use other firefighters to do the 360 for you. How about pre-planning ahead of time what that building looks like? And then set yourself up for success ahead of time. Pre-plan your apparatus for about take into account, you know, the majority of incidents you go to, and set up for success for those incidents, and plan around the small fire, the medium fire, and the large fire, and take into account water supply issues. Plan ahead for getting water quickly and efficiently. Set up fill sites ahead of time. Put quick couplings on the apparatus for fast load and offloading of water. Use experienced drivers. Not a fan of nurse tanking, a new word I use today. Set up fill sites. And train. Make it relevant. Don't waste people's time. Explain the why. Don't be afraid to have fun. And everybody train and participate to make yourself as prepared as possible. Chief, is there anything else you would like to add regarding the challenges in the rural environment or anything at all about being a professional volunteer firefighter, or let's just say a professional firefighter?
Professional firefighter is the way I put it, because, you know, just remember, it doesn't matter where you're from. You put your pants on the same way as everybody else does, and you make yourself professional, not anybody else or the department you're with. So just keep that in mind.
And Chief, if people wanted to get a hold of you, if they had questions or they want to bring you in to do any of your great classes, making training a priority in the volunteer fire service or any of the other great programs that you do, you know, how can people get a hold of you?
I'm on all the social media sites. Facebook's probably my primary, being look me up under Justin Bailey, JustinBailey. Or you can reach out to me by email. It's bailey.justin435@gmail.com.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I appreciate you. I know you're starting a recruit class, and you've got a lot going on, and times are crazy right now for all of us. And I appreciate you taking an hour and a half out of your night to sit down and talk with me and all the great listeners out there, because I learned a lot, and I'm sure they did as well. And I look forward to talking with you some more and seeing you at some of the conferences when we do get back to some sense of normalcy. So thank you so much, Chief.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thanks again. And Justin Bailey, fire chief in Oliver Springs, Tennessee, and also a firefighter in Knoxville Fire Department. Great guest to have on tonight to talk about the rural challenges and some other topics in our fire service, especially training and getting our members fired up to train. So great to have him on board. Thank you for listening in tonight. If anyone would like to get a hold of me, again, my personal email is the best way. It's tamerrill63@aol.com. And again, it's tamerrill, M-E-R-R-I-L-L, the number 63@aol.com. I ask every show, please give my Facebook page, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department, a look and a like. I'm still so close to 10,000. I really want to get to 10,000 likes. I don't know why my kids make fun of me, but it's just a personal goal of mine. So I'm trying so desperately to get there, and I'm just shy of that. So if you could help me, I'd appreciate that. So please give the Professional Volunteer Fire Department Facebook page a like. Have your friends and fellow firefighters give it a like as well. I'm always posting content and informational articles and motivational words of wisdom for you as a firefighter and regarding our great fire service. And also, I did recently create a YouTube channel, the Professional Volunteer Fire Department. It's a work in progress, but I currently have all of my podcasts available for your listening pleasure. They're all neatly listed in chronological order, almost 40 shows so far. I think tonight was my 39th episode. Started doing these for fire engineering back in 2014. Thank you, Chief Halton. And the shows have featured some great guests over the years, including tonight with Chief Bailey. I've had shows with Chief Salka and Lasky and Chief Goldfeder and Lombardo and so many others, and so many other topics relevant to the volunteer fire service, recruitment and retention, fundraising, preventing theft or fiscal mismanagement, using social media properly. We certainly could use that today with what's been going on. I didn't even talk about that earlier, but too many crazy examples of people doing crazy things on social media, representing our great fire service the wrong way and hurting, damaging their reputation and their department's reputation. But anyway, that's a topic for another day. But give my podcast a listen. They're all on there. Other shows on physical fitness and, oh, just so many different things we've covered in the 39 shows so far. I also post some cool historical videos on that channel. I'm a huge fire service history buff, actually. I'm a huge anything American history buff. But on that channel, I've uploaded scores of vintage fire videos and other nostalgic firefighter videos that all fire buffs, I'm sure, would love to check out. So again, give the Facebook page a like. Please subscribe to the Professional Volunteer Fire Department YouTube channel. More is coming. I'm working on a new, revised, polished, modern, cool website. One of my daughters is helping me do that. That should be going to live very shortly. And I'm also on Twitter and Instagram. So there's a lot of ways to get a hold of me and connect with me. And I'd love to hear from all of you out there. Let me know what subjects you want me to talk about. Any guests you'd like me to have on. Like I said, I'd love to do a show on the challenges faced by our wildland volunteer firefighters. If anyone would like to forward a name or a recommendation on who would be good to talk to about that, I'm all ears. So please reach out to me, and we'll schedule a show on that. And I have a lot in the works. Hopefully, we're going to be back to normal sooner than later, and I will see many of you out and about at the conferences once they all open back up. Again, thanks to Fire Engineering and Chief Bobby Halton for allowing us to do what we love, share our message with you on these podcasts. Check them all out. There's so many good ones out there. I'm going to call tonight. I got to go to work tonight, my first shift in 2 weeks, and I'm going to head off to the fire alarm office very shortly and work overnight. And I haven't worked in 2 weeks. Ugh, it's going to be tough to get back into the swing of things. But anyway, my next show is scheduled for Tuesday, August 18th, and I promise you, another great topic up for discussion, another great guest, lots of things to talk about that are relevant to our volunteer fire service. And for you as a firefighter, great guests, great topics. So be watching for that, and thanks for tuning in. Stay safe. And folks, remember, our residents are owed professional service delivered by professional firefighters representing a professional organization. Thanks for listening in. Stay safe. Take care.